This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Obelisk Gate, The Broken Earth, Book 2. Written by N.K. Jemisin. Read by Robin Miles. Includes a Mac and PC compatible PDF of appendices. To those who have no choice but to prepare their children for the battlefield. 1. Nasun, on the rocks. No, I'm telling this wrong. After all, a person is herself and others. Relationships chisel the final shape of one's being. I am me, and you. Demaya was herself and the family that rejected her, and the people of the Fulcrum who chiseled her to a fine point. Cyanite was Alabaster, and Inan, and the people of poor lost Alia and Maeve. Now you are Terimo, and the ash-strewn roads walkers, and your dead children, and also the living one who remains, whom you will get back. That's not a spoiler. You are Essun, after all. You know this already, don't you? Nasun next, then. Nasun was just 8 years old when the world ends. There is no knowing what went through little Nasun's mind when she came home from her apprenticeship one afternoon to find her younger brother dead on the den floor and her father standing over the corpse. We can imagine what she thought, felt, did. We can speculate. But we will not know. Perhaps that is for the best. Here is what I know for certain. That apprenticeship I mentioned? Nasun was in training to become a lorist. The stillness has an odd relationship with its self-appointed keepers of stone lore. There are records of lorists existing as far back as the long-rumored eggshell season. That's the one in which some sort of gaseous emission caused all children born in the Arctics for several years to have delicate bones that broke with a touch and bent as they grew. If they grew. Eumenists and archaeomists have argued for centuries over whether this could have been caused by strontium or arsenic, and whether it should be counted as a season at all, given that it only affected a few hundred thousand weak, pallid little barbarians on the northern tundra. But that is when the peoples of the Arctics gained a reputation for weakness. About 25,000 years ago, according to the lorists themselves, which most people think is a blatant lie. In truth, lorists are an even older part of life in the stillness. 25,000 years ago is simply when their role became distorted into near uselessness. They're still around, though they've forgotten how much they've forgotten. Somehow their order, if it can be called an order, survives despite the first through seventh universities disavowing their work as apocryphal, and probably inaccurate, and despite governments down all the ages undermining their knowledge with propaganda. And despite the seasons, of course. Once lorists came only from a race called Regwo, West Coasters, who had sallow reddish skin and naturally black lips, and who worshipped the preservation of history the way people in less bitter times worshipped gods. They used to chisel stone lore into mountainsides and tablets as high as the sky, so that all would see and know the wisdom needed to survive. Alas, in the stillness, destroying mountains is as easy as an origin toddler's temper tantrum. Destroying a people takes only a bit more effort. So lorists are no longer Regwo, but most of them tint their lips black in the Regwo's memory. Not that they remember why anymore. Now it's just how one knows a lorist. By the lips, and by the stack of polymer tablets they carry, and by the shabby clothes they tend to wear, and by the fact that they usually do not have real comm names. They aren't commless, mind. In theory, they could return to their home comms in the event of a season, although by profession they tend to wander far enough to make returning impractical. In practice, many communities will take them in even during a season, because even the most stoic community wants entertainment during the long, cold nights. For this reason, most lorists train in the arts, music and comedy and such. They also act as teachers and caretakers of the young in times when no one else can be spared for such duty. And most importantly, they serve as a living reminder that others have survived worse through the ages. Every calm needs that. The lorist who has come to Terimo is named Renthri Lorist Stone. All lorists take the calm name Stone and the use name Lorist, it being one of the rarer use castes. She is mostly unimportant, but there is a reason you must know of her. She was once Renthri breeder Tentik, but that was before she fell in love with a lorist who visited Tentik and seduced the then young woman away from a boring life as a glasssmith. Her life would have become slightly more interesting if a season had occurred before she left, for a breeder's responsibility in those times is clear. And perhaps that, too, is what spurred her away. Or maybe it was just the usual folly of young love. Hard to say. Renthri's lorist lover eventually left her on the outskirts of the equatorial city of Penfen with a broken heart and a head full of lore and a wallet full of chipped jades and cabochons and one shoe-print-stained lozenge of Mother of Pearl. Renthri spent the Mother of Pearl to commission her own set of tablets from a napper, used the jade chips to buy traveling supplies and to stay at an inn for the days it took the napper to finish, and bought many strong drinks at a tavern with the cabochons. Then, newly outfitted and with wounds patched, she set out on her own. Thus does the profession perpetuate itself. When Nasun appears at the way station where she has set up shop, it's possible that Renthri thinks about her own apprenticeship. Not the seduction part. Obviously, Renthri likes older women, emphasis on women. The foolish dreamer part. The day previous, Renthri passed through Terimo, shopping at market stalls and smiling cheerfully through her black, daubed lips so as to advertise her presence in the area. She did not see Nasun, on her way home from creche, stop and stare in awe and sudden irrational hope. Nasun has skipped creche today to come and find her, and to bring an offering. This is traditional, the offering, that is, and not teachers' daughters skipping creche. Two adults from town are already at the way station, sitting on a bench to listen while Renthri talks, and Renthri's offering cup has already been filled with brightly colored shards faceted with the quartz mark. Renthri blinks in surprise at the sight of Nasun. A gangly girl, who has more leg than torso, more eyes than face, and very obviously too young to be out of creche so early when it isn't harvest season. Nasun stops on the threshold of the way station, panting to catch her breath, which makes for a very dramatic entrance. The other two visitors turn to stare at her, Jija's normally quiet firstborn, and only their presence stops Nasun from blurting her intentions right then and there. Her mother has taught her to be very circumspect. Her mother will hear about her skipping creche. Nasun doesn't care. She swallows, however, and goes to Renthri immediately to hold out something, a dark chunk of rock, embedded in which can be seen a small, almost cubical diamond. Nasun doesn't have any money beyond her allowance, you see, and she'd already spent that on books and sweets when word came that a lorist was in town. But no one in Terimo knows that there's a potentially excellent diamond mine in the region. No one, that is, except Origins. And then only if they're looking. Nasun's the only one who's bothered in several thousand years. She knows she should not have found this diamond. Her mother has taught her not to display her orogeny, and not to use it outside of carefully prescribed practice sessions that they undertake in a nearby valley every few weeks. No one carries diamonds for currency because they can't be sharded for change easily. But they're still useful in industry, mining and the like. Nasun knows it has some value, but she has no inkling that the pretty rock she's just given to Renthri is worth a house or two. She's only 8. And Nasun is so excited when she sees Renthri's eyes widen at the sight of the glittering lump poking out of the black hunk of a rock that she stops caring that there are others present and blurts, "I want to be a lorist too." Nasun has no idea what a lorist really does, of course. She just knows that she wants very, very much to leave Tenrimo. More on this later. Renthri would be a fool to refuse the offering, and she doesn't. But she doesn't give Nasun an answer right away, partly because she thinks Nasun is cute and that her declaration is no different from any other child's momentary passion. She's right, to a degree. Last month, Nasun wanted to be a Janir. Instead, she asks Nasun to sit, and then she tells stories to her small audience for the rest of the afternoon, until the sun makes long shadows down the valley slope and through the trees. When the other two visitors get up to head home, they eye Nasun and drop hints until she reluctantly comes with them, because the people of Tenrimo will not have it said that they disrespected a lorist by letting some child talk her to death all night. In the wake of her visitors, Renthri stokes up the fire and starts making dinner from a bit of pork belly and greens and cornmeal that she bought in Tenrimo the day before. While she waits for dinner to cook and eats an apple, she turns Nasun's rock in her fingers, fascinated and troubled. In the morning, she heads into Tenrimo. A few discreet inquiries lead her to Nasun's home. Esun's gone by this point, off to teach the last class of her career as a creche teacher. Nasun's gone off to creche too, though she's biding her time till she can escape at lunchtime to go find the lorist again. Jija's in his workshop, as he calls the offset room that passes for the house's basement, where he works on commissions with his noisy tools during the day. Uche is asleep on a pallet in the same room. He can sleep through anything. The songs of the earth have always been his lullaby. Jija comes to the door when Renthri knocks, and for an instant, she's a little taken aback. Jija is a mid-ladder mongrel, same as Essen, though his heritage leans more toward the Sanzed. He's big and brown and muscular and bald-shaven. Intimidating. Yet the welcoming smile on his face is wholly genuine, which makes Renthri feel better about what she's decided to do. This is a good man. She cannot cheat him. "Here," she says, giving him the diamond rock. She can't possibly take such a valuable gift from a child, not in exchange for a few stories and an apprenticeship, which Nasun will probably change her mind about in a few months. Jija frowns in confusion and takes the rock, thanking her profusely after he hears her explanation. He promises to spread the tale of Renthri's generosity and integrity to everyone he can, which will hopefully give her more opportunities to practice her art before she leaves town. Renthri leaves. And that is the end of her part in this tale. It is a significant part, however, which is why I told you of her. There was not any one thing that turned Jija against his son, understand. Over the years, he simply had noticed things about his wife and his children that stirred suspicion in the depths of his mind. That stirring had grown to a tickle, then an outright irritant by the point at which this tale begins. But denial kept him from worrying at the thought any further. He loved his family, after all. And the truth was simply unthinkable. Literally. He would have figured it out eventually, one way or another. I repeat, he would have figured it out eventually. No one is to blame but him. But if you want a simple explanation, and if there can be any one event that became the tipping point, the camel straw, the broken plug on the lava tube, it was this rock. Because Jija knew stone, you see. He was an excellent napper, He knew stone, and he knew Terimo, and he knew that veins of igneous rock from an ancient volcano ran all through the surrounding land. Most did not reach the surface, but it was entirely possible that Nasun could, by chance, find a diamond sitting out where anyone could pick it up. Unlikely, but possible. This understanding floats on the surface of Jija's mind for the rest of the day after Ren-3 leaves. The truth is beneath the surface, a leviathan waiting to uncurl. But the waters of his thoughts are placid for now. Denial is powerful. But then, Uche wakes up. Jija walks him into the den, asking him if he's hungry. Uche says he isn't. Then he smiles at Jija, and with the unerring sensitivity of a powerful Orogen child, he orients on Jija's pocket and says,
"Why is Shiny there, Daddy?"
The words, in his lisping toddler language, are cute. The knowledge that he possesses, because the rock is indeed in Jija's pocket and there's no way Uche could have known it was there, dooms him. Nasun does not know that it started with the rock. When you see her, do not tell her. When Nasun comes home that afternoon, Uche is already dead. Jija is standing over his cooling corpse in the den, breathing hard. It doesn't take a lot of effort to beat a toddler to death, but he hyperventilated while he did it. When Nasun comes in, there's still not enough carbon dioxide in Jija's bloodstream. He's dizzy, shaky, chilled, irrational. So when Nasun pulls up sharply in the doorway of the den, staring at the tableau and only slowly understanding what she sees, Jija blurts, "Are you one too?" He's a big man. It's a loud, sharp blurt. And Nasun jumps. Her eyes jerk up to him, rather than staying on Uche's body, which saves her life. The gray color of her eyes is her mother's, but the shape of her face is Jija's. Just the sight of her pulls him a step away from the primal panic into which he has descended. She tells the truth, too. That helps, because he wouldn't have believed anything else. "Yes," she says. She's not really afraid in this moment. The sight of her brother's body and her mind's refusal to interpret what she's seeing have frozen all cognition within her. She's not even sure what Jija is asking, since understanding the context of his words would require her to acknowledge that what stains her father's fists is blood, and that her brother is not merely sleeping on the floor. She can't, not right then. But absent any more coherent thought, and as children sometimes do in extreme situations, Nasun regresses. What she sees frightens her, even if she does not understand why. And of the two of her parents, it is Jija to whom Nasun has always been closer. She's his favorite too, the firstborn, the one he never expected to have, the one with his face and his sense of humor. She likes his favorite foods. He's had vague hopes of her following in his footsteps as a napper. So when she starts crying, she does not quite know why. And as her thoughts skirl about and her heart screams, she takes a step toward him. His fists tighten, but she cannot see him as a threat. He is her father. She wants comfort. "Daddy," she says. Jija flinches, blinks, stares, as if he has never seen her before. Realizes he cannot kill her. Not even if she is. No. She is his little girl. She steps forward again, reaching out. He cannot make himself reach back, but he does hold still. She grabs his nearer wrist. He stands straddling Uche's body. She can't grab him around the waist the way she wants. She does, however, press her face against his bicep, so comfortingly strong. She does tremble, and he does feel her tears sliding down his skin. He stands there, breath gradually slowing, fists gradually uncurling, while she weeps. After a time, he turns to face her fully, and she wraps arms around his waist. Turning to face her requires turning away from what he's done to Uche. It is an easy movement. He murmurs to her, "Get your things," as if you were going to spend a few nights with Grandma. Jija's mother married again a few years back, and now she lives in Sume, the town in the next valley over, which will soon be destroyed utterly. "Are we going there?" Nasun asks against his belly. He touches the back of her head. He's always done this because she's always liked the gesture. When she was a baby, she cooed louder when he cupped her there. This is because the sesapine are located in that region of the brain, and when he touches her there, she can perceive him more completely, as Origens do. Neither of them has ever known why she likes it so much. "We're going somewhere you can be better," he says gently. "Somewhere I heard of, where they can help you. Make her a little girl again and not..." He turns away from this thought, too. She swallows, then nods and steps back, looking up at him. "Is Mama coming, too?" Something moves across Gigi's face, subtle as an earthquake. "No." And Nasun, who was fully prepared to go off into the sunset with some lorist, effectively running away from home to escape her mother, relaxes at last. "Okay, Daddy," she says, and heads to her room to pack. Jija gazes after her for a long, breath-held moment. He turns away from Uche again, gets his own things, and heads outside to hitch up the horse to the wagon. Within an hour they are away, headed south with the end of the world on their heels. In the days of Jamaria, which died in the season of drowned desert, it was thought that giving the last born to the sea would keep it from coming ashore and taking the rest. From the Breeder's Stand, Lorist Tale recorded in Hanul Quartant, Western Coastals near Brokoff Peninsula. Apocryphal. 2. You continued. "A what?" you say.
"A moon."
Alabaster, beloved monster, sane madman, the most powerful origin in all the stillness and in-progress stone-eater snack, stares at you. This has all of its old intensity, and you feel the will of him. The stuff that makes him the force of nature that he is, as an almost physical rider on that stair. The Guardians were fools to ever consider him tame.
"A satellite."
"A what?" He makes a little sound of frustration. He's completely the same, aside from being partially turned to stone, as the days when you and he were less than lovers and more than friends. 10 years, and another self ago.
"Astronomistry isn't foolishness," he says. "I know you were taught that. Everyone in the stillness thinks it's a waste of energy to study the sky when it's the ground that's trying to kill us, but Earth fires, Cyan. I thought you would have learned to question the status quo a little better by now."
"I had other things to do," you snap, just like you always used to snap at him. But thinking of the old days makes you think of what you've been up to in the meantime. And that makes you think of your living daughter and your dead son, and your soon-to-be very ex-husband, and you flinch physically. "And my name is Esun now, I told you."
"Whatever."
With a groaning sigh, Alabaster carefully sits back against the wall.
"They say you came here with a geomist. Have her explain it to you. I don't have a lot of energy these days."
Because being eaten probably takes a toll,
You didn't answer my first question. Can you do it yet? Can you call the obelisks to you?
It is a question that made no sense when he first asked it, possibly because you were distracted by realizing he was A, alive, B, turning to stone, and C, the Aura Gen responsible for ripping the continent in half and touching off a season that may never end.
The obelisks?
You shake your head, more confused than refusing. Your gaze drifts to the strange object near his bed, which looks like an excessively long pink glass knife and feels like an obelisk, even though it cannot possibly be.
What to...
No.
I don't know.
I haven't tried since Mayov. He groans softly, shutting his eyes.
You're so rusting useless, Cyan. Esun. Never had any respect for the craft.
I respect it fine, I just don't...
Just enough to get by. Enough to excel, but only for gain. They told you how high, and you jumped no further. All to get a nicer apartment and another ring.
For privacy, you ass. And some control over my life. And some rusting respect.
And you actually listened to that guardian of yours? When you don't listen to anyone else? Hey!
10 years as a schoolteacher have given your voice an obsidian edge. Alabaster actually stops ranting and blinks at you. Very quietly, you say, "You know full well why I listened to him." There is a moment of silence. Both of you take this time to regroup.
"You're right," he says at length. "I'm sorry."
Because every Imperial origin listened to their assigned guardian. Those who didn't died or ended up in a node. Except, again, for Alabaster. You never did find out what he did to his guardian. You offer a stiff nod of truce. Apology accepted. He takes a careful breath, looking weary.
"Try, Esun. Try to reach an obelisk. Today, I need to know."
"Why? What's this about a still light? What does..."
"Satellite. And all of it's irrelevant if you can't control the obelisks."
His eyes are actually drifting shut. This is probably a good thing. He'll need his strength if he's to survive whatever is happening to him, if it's survivable.
"Worse than irrelevant. You remember why I wouldn't tell you about the obelisks in the first place, don't you?"
"Yes. Once, before you ever paid attention to those great floating half-real crystals in the sky, you asked Alabaster to explain how he accomplished some of his amazing feats of orogeny. He wouldn't tell you, and you hated him for that. But now you know just how dangerous the knowledge was. If you hadn't understood that the obelisks were amplifiers, orogeny amplifiers, you would never have reached for the garnet to save yourself from a guardian's attack. But if the garnet obelisk hadn't been half-dead itself, cracked and stuffed with a frozen stone-eater, it would have killed you. You didn't have the strength, the self-control, to prevent the power from frying you from the brain on down. And now Alabaster wants you to reach for one deliberately to see what happens?" Alabaster knows your face.
"Go and see," he says.
His eyes shut completely then. You hear a faint rattle in his breath, like gravel in his lungs.
"The topaz is floating somewhere nearby. Call it tonight. Then in the morning, see."
Abruptly, he seems to weaken, running out of strength.
"See if it's come. If it hasn't, tell me, and I'll find someone else. Or do what I can myself."
"Find who to do what? You can't even begin to guess. Will you still tell me what all this is about?"
"No. because in spite of everything, Aeson, I don't want you to die.
He takes a deep breath, lets it out slowly. The next words are softer than usual.
It's good to see you.
You have to tighten your jaw to reply.
Yeah.
He says nothing more, and that's enough of a goodbye for both of you. You get up, glancing at the stone eater who stands nearby. Alabaster calls her Antimony. She stands statue still in the way they do, her two black eyes watching you too steadily, and though her pose is something classical, you think there's a hint of irony in it. She stands with head elegantly tilted, one hand on her hip and the other upraised and poised, with the fingers relaxed, waving in no particular direction. Maybe it's a come hither. Maybe it's a backhanded farewell. Maybe it's that thing people do when they're keeping a secret and want you to know it. But they don't want to tell you what it is.
Take care of him, you say to her. As I would any precious thing, she replies, without moving her mouth.
You're not even going to start trying to interpret that. You head back toward the infirmary entrance, where Hoa stands waiting for you. Hoa, who looks like an utterly strange human boy, who is actually a stone eater somehow, and who treats you as his precious thing. He watches you unhappily, as he has done since you realized what he was. You shake your head and move past him on your way out. He follows at a pace. It's early night in the calm of Castrema. Hard to tell, since the giant geode's soft white light emitted impossibly from the massive crystals that make up its substance never changes. People are bustling about, carrying things, shouting to each other, going about their usual business without the necessary slowdown that would occur in other calms with the reduction of light. Sleeping will be difficult for a few days, you suspect. At least until you get used to this. That doesn't matter. Obelisks don't care about the time of day. Lerna's been politely waiting outside while you and Hoa met with Alabaster and Antimony. He falls in as you come out, his expression expectant. I need to go to the surface, you say. Lerna makes a face.
The guards won't let you, Aeson. People new to the calm aren't trusted. Castrema's survival depends on it remaining secret.
Seeing Alabaster again has brought back a lot of the old memories and the old orneriness. They can try to stop me. Lerna stops walking.
And then you'll do what you did to Tarimo.
Rusting, hell. You stop too, rocking a little from the force of that blow. Hoa stops as well, eyeing Lerna thoughtfully. Lerna's not glaring. The look on his face is too flat to be a glare.
Damn. Okay.
After a moment, Lerna sighs and comes over.
We'll go to Yika, he says. We'll tell her what we need. We'll ask to go topside. With guards, if she wants.
All right. It's so reasonable that you don't know why you didn't even consider it. Well, you know why. Yika might be an aura gen like you, but you spent too many years being thwarted and betrayed by other aura gens at the Fulcrum. You know better than to trust her just because she's your people. You should give her a chance because she is your people, though. Fine, you say, and follow him to Yika's. Yika's place is no larger than yours, and not distinct in any way despite being the home of the calm headwoman. Just another apartment carved by means unknown into the side of a giant glowing white crystal. Two people wait outside of its door, however, one leaning against the crystal and another peering over the railing at the expanse of Castrema. Lerna takes up position behind them and directs you to do the same. Only fair to wait your turn, and the obelisks aren't going anywhere. The woman gazing out at the view glances over and looks you up and down. She's a little older, San said, though darker complected than most, and her bushel of hair is ash-blow with a slight kink to it, making it a frizzy cloud instead of just a coarse one. Got some East Coaster in her, and West Coaster, too. Her gaze is through epicanthic folded eyes, and it is assessing, wary and unimpressed.
You, the new one, she says.
Not a question. You nod back.
Essun.
She grins lopsidedly, and you blink. Her teeth have been filed to points, even though Sunzeds supposedly stopped doing that centuries ago. Bad for their reputation, after the season of teeth.
Hjarka, leadership Kastrima. Welcome to our little hole in the ground.
Her smile widens. You stifle a grimace at the pun, though you're thinking, too, after hearing her name. It's usually bad news when a comm has a leadership cast that isn't in charge. Dissatisfied leaders have a nasty habit of fomenting coups during crises. But this is Yika's problem to deal with, not yours. The other person waiting, the man leaning on the crystal, doesn't seem to be watching you. But you notice how his eyes aren't moving to track whatever he's looking at off in the distance. He's thin, shorter than you, with hair and a beard that make you think of strawberries growing amid hay. You imagine the delicate pressure of his indirect attention. You do not imagine the ping of instinct that tells you he is another of your kind. Since he doesn't acknowledge your presence, you say nothing to him.
He came in a few months ago, Lerna says, distracting you from your new neighbors.
For a moment, you wonder if he means the strawberry hay-haired man. And then you realize he's referring to Alabaster.
Just appeared in the middle of what passes for a town square within the geode. Flattop.
He nods towards something beyond you, and you turn, trying to understand what he means. Ah, there, amid the many sharp-tipped crystals of Kastrima, is one that looks as if it's been sheared off halfway, leaving a wide hexagonal platform positioned and elevated near the center of the calm. Several stair bridges connect to it, and there are chairs and a railing. Flat top. Lerna goes on.
There was no warning. Apparently the Origins didn't sense anything, and the Stills on guard duty didn't see anything. He and that stone eater of his were suddenly just there.
He doesn't see you frown in surprise. You've never heard a Still use the word still before.
Maybe the stone eaters knew he was coming, but they rarely talk to anyone but their chosen people. And in this case, they didn't even do that.
Lerna's gaze drifts over to Hoa, who's studiously ignoring him in that very moment. Lerna shakes his head.
Yika tried to throw him out, of course, though she offered him a mercy killing if he wanted. His prognosis is obvious. Gentle drugs and a bed would be a kindness. He did something when she called the strongbacks, though. The light went out. The air and water stopped. Only for a minute, but it felt like a year. When he let everything come back on, everyone was upset. So Yika said he could stay, and that we should treat his injuries.
Sounds about right. He's a ten-ringer, you say, and an ass. Give him whatever he wants and be nice about it.
He's from the Fulcrum?
Lerna inhales in what seems to be awe.
Earth fires, I had no idea any Imperial origins had survived.
You look at him, too surprised for amusement. But then, how would he know? Another thought sobers you. He's turning to stone, you say softly.
Yes, Lerna says it ruefully. I've never seen anything like it. And it's getting worse. The first day he was here, it was just his fingers that the Stone Eater had taken. I haven't seen how the condition progresses, He's careful to do it only when I or my assistants aren't around. I don't know if she's doing it to him somehow, or he's doing it to himself, or... He shakes his head. When I ask about it, he just grins and says, "Just a bit longer, please. I'm waiting for someone." Lerna frowns at you, thoughtful.
And there's that. Somehow Alabaster knew you were coming. Or maybe he didn't. Maybe he was hoping for someone, anyone with the necessary skill. Good chance of it here, with Yika somehow summoning every Raga for miles. You'll only be what he was waiting for if it turns out you can summon an obelisk. After a few moments, Yika pokes her head out of the apartment through the hanging. She nods at Hjarka, glares at Strawberry Hay until he sighs and turns to face her, then spies you and Lerna and Hoa.
"Oh, hey, good. All of you, come in."
You start to protest. "I need to talk to you in private." She stares back at you. You blink, confused. Thrown. Annoyed. She keeps staring. Lerna shifts from foot to foot beside you, a silent pressure. Hoa merely watches, following your lead. Finally, you get the message. Her calm, her rules. And if you want to live here... You sigh and file in behind the others. Inside, the apartment is warmer than in most of the calm, and darker. The curtain makes a difference, even though the walls glow. Makes it feel like night, which it probably is, topside. A good idea to steal for your own place, you think, before checking yourself, because you shouldn't be thinking long-term. And then you check yourself again, because you've lost Nasun and Jija's trail. So you should think long-term, and then...
"Right," says Yika, sounding bored as she moves to sit on a simple low divan, cross-legged, with her chin propped on a fist.
The others sit as well, but she's looking at you.
"I'd been thinking about some changes already. You two arrived at a convenient time."
For a moment, you think she's including Lerna in that "you two," but he sits down on the divan nearest hers, and there's something, some ease of movement or comfort in his manner that tells you he's heard this before. She means Hoa, then. Hoa takes the floor, which makes him seem more like a child, though he isn't. It's strange how hard it is for you to remember that. You sit down gingerly.
"Convenient for what?" "I still don't think this is a good idea,"
Strawberry Hay says. He's looking at you, though his face is tilted toward Yika.
"We don't know anything about these people, Yik."
"We know they survived out there until yesterday," says Hjarka, leaning to the side and propping her elbow on the divan's arm. "That's something."
"That's nothing."
Strawberry Hay, you really want to know his name, sets his jaw.
"Our hunters can survive out there."
"Hunters?" You blink. "That's one of the old use castes. A deprecated one, per imperial law, so nobody gets born into it anymore. Civilized societies don't need hunter-gatherers." That Kastrima feels the need says more about the state of the calm than anything else Yika has told you.
"Our hunters know the terrain, and our strong backs too, yeah?" Hjarka says.
"Nearby. Newcomers know more about the conditions beyond our territory. The people, the hazards, everything else."
"I'm not sure I know anything useful," you begin. But even as you say this, you frown, because you're remembering that thing you started noticing a few roadhouses ago. The sashes or rags of fine silk on too many of the Equatorial's wrists. The closed looks they gave you. Their focus, while others sat shell-shocked. At every encampment, you saw them look their fellow survivors over, picking out any sunzeds who were better equipped or healthier or otherwise doing better than average. Speaking to those chosen people in quiet voices, leaving the next morning in groups larger than those in which they had arrived.
Does that mean anything?
Like keeping to like is the old way. but races and nations haven't been important for a long time. Communities of purpose and diverse specialization are more efficient, as old Sans proved. Yet Eumenes is slag at the bottom of a fissure vent by now, and the laws and ways of the Empire no longer have any bite. Maybe this is the first sign of change, then. Maybe in a few years you'll have to leave Kostrima and find a calm full of mid-ladders like you, who are brown but not too brown, big but not too big, with hair that's curly or kinky but never ash-blow or straight. Nasun can come with you in that case. But how long would the both of you be able to hide what you are? No calm wants Ragas. No calm except this one.
You know more than we do, Ika says, interrupting your wool gathering. And anyway, I don't have the patience to argue about it. I'm telling you what I told him a few weeks back.
She jerks her head at Lerna.
I need advisors, people who know this season, ground to sky. You're it until I replace you.
You're more than a little surprised. I don't know a rusting thing about this calm.
That's my job, and his and hers.
Ika nods towards Strawberry Hay and Tjarka.
Anyway, you'll learn.
Your mouth hangs open. Then it occurs to you that she did include Hoa in this gathering, didn't she? Earth fires and rust buckets. You want a stone eater as an advisor?
Why not? They are here too. More of them than we think.
She focuses on Hoa, who watches her, his expression unreadable.
That's what you taught me.
It's true, he says quietly. Then, I can't speak for them, though, and we aren't part of your calm.
Ika leans down to give him a hard look.
Her expression is something between hostile and guarded.
You have an impact on our calm, if only as a potential threat, she says.
Her eyes flick toward you.
And the ones you're attached to are part of this calm. You care what happens to them at least, don't you?
You realize you haven't seen Yika's stone eater, the woman with the ruby hair, for a few hours. That doesn't mean she isn't nearby, though. You learned better than to trust the appearance of absence with antimony. Hoa says nothing in reply to Ika. You're suddenly, irrationally glad he's bothered to stay visible for you.
As for why you and why the doctor,
Ika says, straightening, and speaking to you even if she's still eyeing Hoa,
it's because I need a mix of perspectives. A leader, even if she doesn't want to lead.
She eyes Tjarka.
Another local Rogga, who doesn't bother to bite his tongue about how stupid he thinks I am.
She nods to Strawberry Hay, who sighs.
A resistant and a doctor who knows the road. A stone eater, me, and you, Esun, who could kill us all.
She smiles thinly.
Makes sense to give you a reason not to.
You have no real idea what to say. To that, you think fleetingly that Yika should invite Alabaster to her circle of advisors, then, if the ability to destroy Kostrima is a qualification. But that could lead to awkward questions. To Tjarka and Strawberry Hay, you say, are you both from here?
Nope, says Tjarka.
Yes, says Yika.
Tjarka glares at her.
You've lived here since you were young, here.
Tjarka shrugs.
Nobody here remembers that except you, Yik.
Strawberry Hay says,
I was born and raised here.
Two Orogens, surviving to adulthood in a calm that didn't kill them. What's your name?
Gata Strongback.
You wait. He smiles with half his mouth and neither of his eyes.
Kata's secret wasn't out, so to speak, while we were growing up, Ika says.
She's leaning against the wall behind the divan now, rubbing her eyes as if she's tired.
People guessed anyway. The rumors were enough to keep him from being adopted into the comm, under the previous headman. Of course,
I've offered to give him the name a half dozen times over now.
If I give up Stronbach,
Cutter replies. He's still smiling in that paper-thin way. Yika lowers her hand. Her jaw is tight.
Denying what you are didn't keep people from knowing what you are. And flaunting it isn't what saved you.
Yika takes a breath. The muscles in her jaw flex, relax.
And that would be why I asked you to do this, Cutter. But let's move on.
So it goes on. You sit there throughout the meeting, trying to understand the undercurrents you're picking up on, still not believing you're even here while Yika lays out all of the problems facing Kostrima. It's stuff you've never had to think about before. Complaints that the hot water in the communal pools isn't hot enough. A serious shortage of potters, but an overabundance of people who know how to sew. Fungus in one of the granary caverns. Several months' supply had to be burned, lest it contaminate the rest. A meat shortage. You've gone from thinking obsessively about one person to having to be concerned with many. It's a bit sudden.
I just took a bath, you blurt, trying to pull yourself out of a daze. The water was nice. Of course you thought it was nice. You've been living rough for months, bathing in cold streams, if you even bothered. A lot of the people in Kostrima have never lived without reliable geo and adjustable faucets.
Yika rubs her eyes. The meeting's only been an hour or so, but it feels longer.
Everybody copes with a season in their own way.
Complaining about nothing doesn't seem like coping to you, but okay.
Being low on meat is an actual problem, Lerna says, frowning.
I noticed. The last few comm shares didn't have any. Or eggs. Hika's expression grows grimmer.
Yes, that's why.
For your sake, she adds,
we don't have a Greenland in this comm, if you haven't noticed yet. The soil around here is poor, all right for gardening, but not for grass or hay. Then, for the last few years before the season started, everyone was so busy arguing about whether we should rebuild the old pre-choking wall that nobody thought to contract with an agricultural comm for a few dozen cartloads of good soil.
She sighs, rubbing the bridge of her nose.
Can't bring most livestock down the mine shafts and stairs anyway. I don't know what we were thinking trying to live down here. This is exactly why I need help.
Her weariness isn't a surprise, but her willingness to admit error is. It's also troubling. You say, a comm can only have one leader during a season.
Yeah, and that's still me. Don't you forget it.
It could be a worn-off, but it doesn't sound like one. You suspect it's just a matter-of-fact acceptance of her place in Kostrima. The people chose her, and for the time being they trust her. They don't know you, Lerna, or Hoa, and apparently they don't trust Hjarka and Cutter. You need her more than she needs any of you. Abruptly, though, Yika shakes her head.
I can't talk about this shit anymore.
Good, because the looming sense of disjunct, this morning you were thinking of the road and survival and Nasun, is beginning to feel overwhelming.
I need to go topside.
It's too abrupt a change of subject, apparently out of the blue, and for a moment they all stare at you.
The rust for? Yika asks.
Alabaster. Yika looks blank. The Ten Ringer in your infirmary? He asked me to do something.
Yika grimaces. Oh, him.
You can't help smiling at this reaction.
Interesting. He hasn't talked to anyone since he got here. Just sits in there using up our antibiotics and eating our food.
I just made a batch of psyllin, Yika. Lerna rolls his eyes.
It's the principle of the thing.
You suspect Alabaster's been quelling the local microshakes and any aftershocks from the north, which would more than earn his keep. But if Yika can't assess that for herself, explaining is pointless, and you're not sure you can trust her enough to talk about Alabaster yet. He's an old friend.
There,
That's a good, if incomplete, summary. You didn't seem the type to have friends. You either. She regards you for a long moment. Are you a tenringa too? Your fingers flex involuntarily. I wore 6 rings once. Lerna's head snaps around and he stares at you. Well. Cutter's face twitches in a way you can't interpret. You add, Alabaster was my mentor back when I was still with the Fulcrum.
I see. And what does he want you to do, topside?
You open your mouth, then close it. You can't help glancing at Hjarka, who snorts and gets to her feet. And Lerna, whose expression tightens as he realizes you don't want to speak in front of him. He deserves better than that. But still, he's a still. Finally, you say, origin business. It's weak. Lerna's face goes blank, but his eyes are hard. Hjarka waves and heads for the curtain.
Then I'm out. Come on, Cutter, since you're just a strongback.
She barks out a laugh. Cutter stiffens, but to your surprise, he rises and follows her out. You eye Lerna for a moment, but he folds his arms. Not going anywhere. All right. In the wake of this, Yika looks skeptical.
What is this, a final lesson from your old mentor? He's obviously not going to live much longer.
Your jaw tightens before you can help it. That remains to be seen. Yika looks thoughtful for a moment longer, and then she nods decisively, getting to her feet.
All right, then. Just let me get some strongbacks together and we'll be on our way.
Wait, you're coming? Why?
Curiosity. I want to see what a Fulcrum's 6-ringer can do.
She grins at you and picks up the long fur vest you first saw her wearing.
Maybe see if I can do it, too.
You flinch violently at the idea of a self-taught feral attempting to connect to an obelisk. No. Yika's expression flattens. Lerna stares at you, incredulous that you would achieve your goal and then scuttle it in the same breath. Quickly, you amend yourself. It's dangerous even for me, and I've done it before.
It.
Well, that does it. It's safer that she not know, but Lerna's right. You have to win this woman over if you're going to be living in her calm. Promise me you won't try if I tell you.
I won't promise a rusting thing. I don't know you.
Yika folds her arms. You're a big woman. But she's a little bigger, and the hair doesn't help. Many sunsets like to grow their ashblow hair into big poofy manes like hers. It's an animal intimidation thing, and it works if they've got the confidence to back it up. Yika's got that and then some. But you have knowledge. You push to your feet and meet her eyes.
You can't do it, you say. Will her to believe. You don't have the training. You don't know what kind of training I have.
And you blink, remembering that moment topside when the realization that you'd lost Nassen's trail nearly unhinged you. That strange, sweeping waft of power Yika sent through you, like a slap, but kinder, and somehow orogenic. Then there's her little trick of drawing origins for miles around toward Kastrima. Yika may not wear rings, but orogeny isn't about rank. No help for it, then.
An obelisk, you say, relenting.
You glance at Lerna. He blinks and frowns. Alabaster wants me to call an obelisk. I'm going to see if I can. To your surprise, Yika nods, her eyes alight.
Aha! Always thought there was something about those things. Let's go then. I definitely want to see this.
Oh, shit. Yika shrugs on the vest. Give me a half hour, then meet me at Scenic Overlook. That's the entrance to Kastrima, that little platform where newcomers invariably gawk at the strangeness of a calm inside a giant geode. With that, She brushes past you and out of the apartment. Shaking your head, you eye Lerna. He nods tightly. He wants to go too.
Hola?
He simply takes up his usual place.